Coffee. The fuel of podcasts.
That's true.
Advent.
Advent.
I love Advent.
Me too.
Yeah. Let's talk about it.
Let's. So it's a season.
Right, and it is the first season of the liturgical year.
It is. It's when everything changes.
So how did that, I mean, first of all, does that matter? Like, do people really know that? I mean, I know that like every priest in the entire Episcopal Church thinks he or she is hysterical when they come out at the beginning of the Advent service or at the announcements and say, Happy New Year!
Really? I've never heard anyone do that.
Don't lie.
No, it happens.
Yeah,
a lot.
It literally happens every Advent.
Sometimes it happens the week before Advent and the week of Advent too. Like, sometimes they just can't get the joke in enough.
Oh, that's kind of dire.
Yeah.
I mean, if I may pass judgment on that activity, well, please
too
don't.
Too late. You did.
Yeah. Please don't do it more than once. So, yeah, it is funny. I think, in all seriousness, I think that joke is worth doing in a day and age when people may not be aware of the liturgical calendar as much as the church might want them to be.
Right.
But what does it mean? What does it mean that the year starts with this? I mean, I guess it makes sense because it is the birth of Jesus, and then the year begins with his infancy and proceeds to his earthly ministry, and then we go through Lent, we go through Easter, the resurrection.
But what's really interesting about it is the way that the lectionary has this as sort of a double season. It is both preparation for the incarnation of God, but more than that, it has an eschatological bent. It has this expectation of the second coming and the fulfillment of all creation.
It does. And you get that eschatological bent to the end of the liturgical year. The end of the year sort of being in November. And then it really intensifies in Advent. So you're right that in a way that's not so much the beginning of the year it is that, but it's also the sort of fulfillment and conclusion of that arc of prophecy and scripture.
I think there's something really interesting about the fact that we sort of begin at the end point.
Right.
And then when we work our way through to Easter, one of the readings at the Easter Vigil is the creation of the world.
Right.
You know? So I think that viewing this as merely a chronological sequence tracing the life, the earthly life and ministry of Jesus Christ, is reading against the lectionary. Hmm. It's sort of a simplistic reading of the church calendar.
Mm-hmm. But the church calendar, I mean, talk about a complicated thing that's evolved over, a couple thousand years at this point. We shouldn't be so literal about, like, this is the start of the year.
Right.
I mean, because it is, for me, the excitement of the Christian faith is the whole story all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're in Advent, to think about the implications of the resurrection. And
right.
Like you say, when you're at Easter, to think about that in connection with creation. Mm-hmm. That there are these really kind of unexpected juxtapositions to our modern sensibilities. But for Christians in medieval times, these were the images, literally, these were the images that they were presented with. One example I can think of that I didn't really appreciate is the connection between the Tower of Babel and Pentecost.
Right.
I had no idea that those two things were sort of linked in the Christian imagination, but if you think about it, yeah, there's some really interesting food for thought there. The scattering of the languages at the destruction of the tower, and then the understanding of all languages at Pentecost.
The lectionary in general, but particularly during Advent, always has images like that sort of playing off one another. That's one of the reasons why we never read, I shouldn't say never, why we're not really supposed to read just one reading at a Eucharistic service. Because you're meant to have a multiplicity of images because they play off one another and cause you to see them differently. And Advent is sort of the perfect illustration of that because you have these two different themes playing out. Mm-hmm. in preparation for the incarnation, as in the incarnation in the person of Jesus Christ, but also preparation for the end times and fulfillment of all creation.
So one of the things that I think happens in a lot of Episcopal churches at the start of the Advent season is something about the liturgy changes. I mean, I can almost guarantee you, no matter what church it is, something is changing for the season of Advent.
Right.
You know, be it the Eucharistic prayer, maybe switching from Eucharistic prayer A to prayer B. Mm-hmm. And we could talk about whether people notice that or have any idea what that means.
Right.
You know, just, I guess I want to just pose a general question to you.
Mm-hmm.
Should the liturgy on Advent Sunday, on the first Sunday of Advent, should it change from significantly from what you had the week before?
Well, I think that the short answer is absolutely yes. If we're changing the color of our vestments,
right,
then we're doing that to say that there is something different, mm-hmm, about this Sunday as opposed to the previous Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the fact that we change our vestments for an entire season, even though it's a relatively short season, I think that means something. And if the only change that happens is that the color on the altar is different, then the idea of Advent as a season gets lost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what color should we change it to? Blue or purple?
Well, good question is the short answer.
There's this idea, I want to know if this is really true,
uh-huh,
that blue was propagated in as a liturgical color for Advent to increase vestment and parament sales.
I think it's one of those things that would be tough to disprove,
mm-hmm,
but I don't know that there's any strong evidence for it necessarily.
Because people who use blue talk about the serum use.
Yes.
The color, the sort of color scheme in use, mm-hmm, at Salisbury Cathedral in England at a certain time. But I don't think we know. Actually, I think we know that it was not blue.
Right.
We don't know exactly what color it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, that idea I think is sort of has been questioned.
Well, and Neil Alexander says that both blue and purple vestments are a result of early dyeing procedures,
right,
in an attempt to make black.
Mm-hmm.
That the dye would in fact fade
over time. It would become blue or it'd become purple.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think blue comes more from a sort of contemporary urge to distinguish Advent from Lent. We want to do something to say that Advent is not merely penitential, is not just another season of penitence like Lent is. And so how do we do that? Well, you know, we sort of gravitate toward blue because there's an understanding, even if it's mistaken, that there's some historicity there and maybe some justification for it.
So I see what you're saying. It offsets the association with the truly penitential season of Lent.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And blue has that secondary qualification of being associated with Mary, who is, of course, I mean, I guess if Jesus is the reason for the season at Christmas,
uh-huh,
you almost have to say that Mary is the reason for the season at Advent.
Well, you could make that argument. Yeah,
I did.
No, that's fair. And I think, I mean, but I think that there are probably plenty of people in the Episcopal Church who are not necessarily as comfortable with veneration of Mary.
Really? Why not? Say more about this. It's the first I've ever heard that.
Because it's so Catholic.
So Catholic, but Mary is the mother of Jesus.
Right.
Is Jesus Catholic?
No, but he did establish the first Pope of Rome.
That's true. All right, so, but I mean, here's where I would push back if someone said, I don't want to celebrate Mary. I would say, well, look at the calendar of the prayer book and find that the Virgin Mary is listed there in August.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I just think if it were consciously agreed upon as a season of Mary, there would be some resistance to that.
I see.
I think that in the public consciousness for the majority of Episcopalians, if you said to them, oh, so you use blue in Advent because it's the season of Mary, there might be some pushback.
No, I mean, as with all liturgical seasons, there's so much more to it than any one image or person. One of the changes that you're going to make in Advent is you're going to swap out the Gloria. You're probably not going to sing the Gloria.
Historically, we probably didn't, because it tended to be a more penitential season. But because there are so many people who want to resist that, who want to say this is not another penitential season, this is not a little Lent, I think that you will have some people who say, no, sing the Gloria. If we can sing the Magnificat, why can't we sing the Gloria?
I can't think of any specific cases of that at all. So listeners, if you know of a place that continues with the Gloria during the season of Advent, we'd love to know about it. Mm-hmm. I think it's more typical that you would see a Kyrie or your favorite, the Trisagion.
That's right.
Which I will be doing this Advent. More typically see that at the beginning of the liturgy. But is there, I mean, one of the things that I struggle with musically, and I think clergy and gosh, altar guilds and acolytes all struggle with this. Whatever changes you institute, it is a very short season. It's 4 Sundays. Our lives typically get a little bit crazier in December. So people, you know, might be running a little bit late to church and might not, you know, remember all the details about how to light the Advent wreath or whatever it is. I mean, there may be some confusion.
Yeah.
With just given the short period of the Advent season.
I think that, so there is some evidence in the early, although not too early church, of some places having a 7-week Advent season where early was a little Lent.
Right.
And I think that I have seen some churches and even some dioceses actually sort of try and institute that as a sort of trial practice, not necessarily a widespread permanent change in the calendar, but trying it out for a year or something like that.
What do you think about that?
I think that it's interesting. There needs to be a good deal of intentionality behind it, but it solves some of those logistical problems of doing something for 4 Sundays or 3 Sundays in a bit, like we have this year, because Advent 4 will be Christmas Eve. So probably
Be the eve, it'll be Christmas Eve morning.
Right. Yeah. Right. But you'll have a lot of people who go, oh, today's Christmas Eve, so
I'll go to church in the evening.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's very true. Advent wreaths. Are they a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, I appreciate like the visual marker of, you know, when the wreath appears. Oh yeah, it's clearly Advent because we don't get that wreath out any other time of year.
Right.
But what I don't like is some of the fussiness and attention that we build up around it. I mean, the most egregious examples I can think of are related to naming each candle. You know, the joy candle, the hope candle, peace candle. And then not only naming the candle, but also kind of inventing little pieces of the liturgy that go along with that. I mean, it just seems sort of like a lot of fuss over a sort of relatively made up object. Does it serve the season or is it a distraction?
I would evoke Shakespeare, who said, there's nothing either good or bad, Horatio, but thinking makes it so. I think that I think that it can be valuable as a practice. I think that it's one of those things that is most valuable as a home practice.
Yeah, I was going to say, I really like having one, because not only in my home, but also in my choir room. I have a,
yeah,
I have a fire, what I believe to be a fire safe, a fire safety Advent wreath that, uh-huh, that I can keep up there.
But I think in that context, it allows a sort of focal point for the season. It allows, it sort of naturally facilitates discussion around the season. I think that when we smack it at the beginning of our liturgy, and if we fuss over it too much, so for example, if we fuss over the lighting of an Advent candle, mm-hmm, more than we do the lighting of a Paschal candle,
well, there you go. Yeah.
What message are we conveying about Advent versus,
right,
Easter?
So where does that come from, this idea to like fuss over the Advent candle more so than you would over the Paschal candle, which if you're going to talk about hierarchy of candles,
right,
which we are,
right,
that is the most important candle.
It's true. I mean, just, yeah, look at the size of it.
Right. And not only its impressive size, but also its ornate decoration with the year in which it was first lit. I, mm-hmm, mean, it's significantly marked. And if you see all the liturgical machinations around the inauguration of that candle the first time it's lit,
uh-huh,
you can't help but think this candle is a big deal,
right?
Yeah.
But in a lot of congregations where a fuss is made over the Advent wreath and lighting of Advent candles, those elements of lighting the Paschal candle take place behind the scenes,
right?
And that's not universally true.
Right.
I don't mean to make too broad a generalization, but a lot of times, if you have a congregation that's making a big deal out of the, mm-hmm, Advent wreath, they're not doing the same with the Paschal candle, and vice versa.
Mm.
And I think that that's the one thing that we have to realize is that sometimes we're conveying
the wrong message.
Unintentionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that comes from people thinking, well, kids really get a lot out of this, so let's do something for the kids.
But there again, you know, maybe in the Sunday school room or in the home situation, mm-hmm, it's much more meaningful.
I think so.
Than it would be.
I think so, and I think there's a way to do it well before the liturgy begins.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it needs to be simple, and I think that the best thing for it, I think that the best context for it to take place in is a more intimate setting, because then you can have a discussion around it.
Yeah. And we talked about, you know, ways, and when we were talking about theology of worship, that idea that it's not just on Sunday. Worship is not just on Sunday.
Right.
So if the Advent wreath in your home, mm-hmm, allows you the opportunity to engage with your faith and prayer,
right,
in your family life or in your home life, that seems like a really good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, don't get me started on the pink candle.
Hey, what do you think about the pink candle?
Well,
I'm for it.
The problem is, mm-hmm, if we get away from Advent as a penitential season to the point where we don't want to say it's in any way penitential,
yeah,
then what sense does it make to have a lightening of the purple?
Right. And so just to fill in people who may not know what we're talking about, typically the third candle in the four candle Advent wreath is a pink candle. So your other candles are blue, are purple, if you really identify with the penitential season. If maybe your place doesn't go in for Advent as a penitential season, they might be blue. But in either case, it's possible to see the third candle there would be a pink candle. And the tradition here comes from the day actually is named from the first word of the Latin introit, Gaudete. Rejoice. And in the Western church, the tradition was for those proper pieces of the liturgy to have a slightly lighter tone, because you're now more than halfway through this season, and whether you want to call it a penitential season or not, it's up to you, but you're halfway through the season of waiting for Christmas, and that was a cause for a minor celebration.
Yeah.
The parallel to this, just really quickly, is in Lent. When you've got, what, five Sundays of Lent, then Palm Sunday.
Oh, right, right.
Am I right about that?
I think so.
And in that case, it's the fourth candle. There's no candle in Lent. it's the fourth Sunday of Lent that also has a parallel name, again, taken from the first word of the introit, laetare, which is another word for effectively meaning rejoice or lighten up.
Right, right. And so in some cases, the vestments were pink or right. rose.
On both days, on the third Sunday of Advent mm-hmm. and the fourth Sunday of Lent. And you better believe that if you invested in pink vestments, you're going to get the minimum bang for your buck mm-hmm. of wearing them twice a year.
Exactly. Yeah. And but it was meant to symbolize a lightening of the restrictions of the fast during each of those times. So if you don't view Advent as penitential, if you don't view it as a sort of preparation or fasting, then it just doesn't make sense to have a lightening of restrictions that aren't there.
Well, so this is really interesting, because as much as some people might want to dismiss the idea of Advent as a penitential season, mm-hmm. let's assume that you haven't gone so far as to start singing Christmas carols all during the month of December in your liturgy.
Please, let's assume that.
Okay, I think like 99% of the Episcopal Church is on board with that. I could be wrong, but like my sense from people far and wide is that that's generally not happening.
Uh-huh.
Well, then let's look at the content of the Advent hymns and also the piece of service music that you have at the beginning, be it a Kyrie or a Trisagion. There is an element of penitence. Mm-hmm. You're using the phrase, Lord have mercy. There's definitely a shift of tone in the music and the words of the hymns that we're singing.
Right.
Thanks for joining us today for this episode of All Things Right and Musical. We hope you enjoyed this episode about all things Advent. You can find more information about this episode and listen to us on the web at writeandmusical.org. That's spelled R-I-T-E and musical.org. We hope that you'll like us on Facebook. You can also send an email to writeandmusical@gmail.com. If you're on Twitter, you can find us there too. Now that you've heard a few of our very first episodes, we hope that you'll leave us a rating in iTunes. When you do that, it lets us know that you're listening, and it helps more listeners find our show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hi, it's us again.
I'm David.
I'm Ian. And we wanted to let you know about our new Patreon page.
We know that you love all things right and musical.
I mean, we assume you do. Why else would you be listening for this long?
Right. So we want to tell you that it costs us a little bit of money to run this podcast.
Not very much so.
Just a little bit. To pay for things like the web hosting.
And the domain name.
So how much exactly does it cost?
We actually don't know. But at the rate we're growing... around $6 a month.
Cool. So why should I give a dollar or two a month to the podcast through Patreon?
Well, you'll feel good contributing towards something you're listening to, and Patreon will allow us to connect more with you, our devoted or at least ambivalent listeners.
That's right. I love giving to my public radio station, and I hope that people will have the same feeling if they really enjoy listening to this podcast. And if you become a patron of All Things Right and Musical on Patreon, you'll have access to information about new episodes before they air.
We send exclusive updates just to our patrons, including sneak previews of upcoming episodes.
That's right. You can see upcoming episode artwork. And depending on how much you give, you might even be able to hear sneak previews of new episodes. And you can even join us for the occasional live chat.
Wow. So what happens if we raise more than $6 a month through Patreon?
Well, I don't know. What do you think? I'm thinking we should fly first class to New York and try to interview Michael Curry.
To the moon.
He's
not there, is he?
Well, he's only to celebrate Eucharistic Prayer C.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Okay. Yeah, I think, no, seriously, we could find some big names to interview.
Yeah.
And go to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, if we really hit the jackpot here, I mean, if the thousands and thousands of people who listen to all the All Things Right musical podcast each gave $2 or $3 a month, we could go on a field trip to see liturgies that people wanted us to experience and podcast about.
Absolutely. And if you go buck wild, we'll even listen to your suggestions.
That's right. Do pay a visit to our new Patreon page. There's a link in this and every upcoming episode that will help you find it. Okay, now I was editing one of our podcasts, and I noticed you and I say this word differently.
Which?
I say eschatological, and you say eschatological.
I do.
Yeah, which you're right, aren't you?
I mean, it's hard for me to say that I'm wrong, because if I thought that I were, I probably would say it differently.
Whereas I just have no idea, and I say it the way that I hear it the most.
But I don't actually know.
Okay. Thank you for joining us today for this episode of All Things and Musical. We hope that you enjoyed this episode about All Things Advent.
I'm gonna have to cut you off. You said All Things and Musical.
Shoot.
Sorry.
Glad you caught that.